This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. And I'm here with that chap called Alan, as ever. How are you doing this week, Alan?
I'm brilliant, Parv. I'm hyped to be on the show. We're on number 19 now of Letters from Kayfabe. So we're on a good run at the moment, and we want people's questions still, don't we, Parv?
Absolutely. How can people send us questions?
Right, if you want to send us questions to our sack to get it even more bulging, the best two ways to do that are emailing us at lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com, where you can do a long-form question on there. Or if you just want a short question you want to ask us, you can do that on Twitter if you use the hashtag lettersfromkayfabe. So send the questions in. We're looking for things around the time frame from, you know, the early 80s. We'll stretch up to like 1980, all the way up to like 97, 98, 99 if needs be. But yeah, anything obscure or people you kind of want us to discuss in length or in depth a bit more, ask the questions and we'll be happy to answer them.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go to the mailbag.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Okay, so here we go with the first question this week is, Dear Alan and Parv, what title changes weren't filmed? Thanks. And that's from John Smith in Kansas City, Kansas. So thank you very much for the question there, John. And out of all the title changes, Parv, the majority of them obviously were filmed because, you know, you want to push the title change. It's for obvious reasons. But there was a number that we've dug up that, you know, didn't make tape or weren't shown for a few reasons. So the first one, you know, the first few were the world title ones. I mean, there was obvious ones going right back to Bruno and Sammartino, Buddy Rogers, Bruno and Ivan Koloff, Pedro Morales and Stasiak, and Bruno and Stasiak were not filmed at all. There may have been really rough handheld footage, but this is the era, really, Parv, 60s and 70s, where you weren't going to get much handheld stuff at all.
I mean, the 60s as a decade is more or less dark. Like, it's a very dark decade in terms of... In fact, not a lot of people know this, but there was actually a kind of nationwide semi-ban on TV footage across the decade of the 60s, which is why we have a lot of 50s stuff. And then in the 70s, you get more footage. But generally, there was some sort of ruling. And I can come back to you on that in later weeks if you want full details. But I remember years ago, I was doing a show with Kelly from the Titans. And we were actually reading about it in magazines from the 60s about how wrestling wasn't allowed on TV for various different reasons. State Athletic Letter Commission deal or whatever it was. There we go.
So, yeah, none of those saw the light of day. And more recent times, we had Pedro Morales beating Kempetera for the IC title in 1980, Parv. There's no kind of mention of why that didn't make tape, but that's not one that's seen the light of day, I believe.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I wonder why that was. And I was just thinking through it. That's kind of unusual for an IC title switch not to happen on TV in that day and age.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're just going on and talk about the IC title. The Tito Don Morocco title change in Boston was actually filmed, but apparently shortly thereafter the ending was somehow lost. So I don't know what happened with that one. So I mean, I don't know if some of the match actually made tape and was aired, but they couldn't show the finish, or because the finish was missing they didn't show it at all. But that's another one that has been lost to the annals of time, unfortunately. So that title change, Tito Morocco, would that have been 84, Parv?
Yeah, seems like it to me. Yeah, Tito 84 sounds about right.
So you know, after that, everything was aired, and you know, in the 80s, going forward was, you know, made TV, or made, you know, a DVD release after the event. But there was another one as well. Was in the 90s when Money Inc's first title win over LOD was supposedly taped handheld style, but also hasn't turned locked up and may be lost in a vault somewhere, apparently. And apparently as well, LLD weren't happy about the loss being shown on TV to begin with. And the finish with the natural disasters were actually interfering. It was unusable considering the changing direction WWF went after WrestleMania 8. So they turned face around that time, so that wasn't used as well. So there was a kind of few things kind of resulted in that title change never really seen the light of day.
Well, as you can imagine, this is something of a little kind of hobby topic of mine, the Money Inc. Title switches. I was a big Money Inc. fan when I was a kid, and I always remember seeing these in, like, PWI at the time, thinking, oh, you know, what's going on here? You know, I was seeing the results and thinking, like, I've never believed that match where... Because if you actually look at the results, I believe it's, like, we're meant to believe, like, IRS pinned Hawk or something like that. Which, if you think back to the time frame, it just seems ridiculous. Can you imagine IRS pinning Hawk?
In 1992, I mean, IRS was never positioned as kind of super strong at all, even, you know, up until the Million Dollar Corporation stuff he was doing around 95. He was just kind of a guy that was there. So, yeah, it was kind of not something that you would expect to see on TV. So, I would say it was a combination of all the things, wouldn't you say, Parv? I think LOD not being happy would have played into it. Also not making tape was, you know, natural disasters interference, obviously turn face. So I think those things really resulted in, you know, wouldn't really make sense to show it.
Yeah, and I remember talking to a guy called Pete F3 from the boards a number of years ago, where we were going back and forth about, like, debating, like, did this match ever happen? And he swears blind that this match did happen. There is tape of it and all of this stuff is true. So, but I won't believe it until I see it. It's actually one of my Holy Grail matches, the LOD one, because until I see evidence that Irwin pinned either one of those guys, I'm not believing it.
was it kind of a screwy finish with Jimmy Hart involved?
I can imagine there was some shenanigans. There's no way, like, that was clean. Briefcase, you know, referee's hand being...
I think it was the disasters obviously interfered, like I mentioned before, and that was to set up the planned WrestleMania 8 LOD disasters in an ODQ match and Money Inc. defending the titles against Slaughter and Duggan, and then the Hall got suspended, if you remember, and the TV exclamation was different. Jimmy Hart double crossed the disasters and got a Money Inc. title shot behind their backs, leading to the disasters turning babyface. With this change, the finisher, even if taped, was pretty much unusable for that reason. So it's interesting because obviously you're a big Money Inc. fan, but the other one that didn't make tape, Parv, was the second of the Money Inc. Steiner's title changes.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one you probably tried to track down again, you know, years later.
Again, as a kid, I remember seeing it in PWI and, like, being quite happy that it meant, like, another tag title for Irwin, of course. That made him, like, I think a five-time tag champ or something, if you include his US Express stuff. Never turned up. And that's unusual, weird, because these two actually had quite a lot of matches that made tape, these two teams, but some of the title changes didn't. And it's actually interesting, because I think this was part of a strategy at the time that Vince was using, like, to try to boost, you know, how shows were down in the early 90s. So they were trying to incentivize people to actually go to live shows. So this is the idea that basically anything can happen. Even a title switch could happen at a, you know, some show with 3,000 people on at it somewhere, you know. So I think that's why they were doing these more in kind of 92, 93 sort of time. I want to say, Brett versus Ric Flair didn't air, did it? It later turned up on a Coliseum tape.
The one from Saskatoon.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that one as well. There's also the one with the Mountie and Bret Hart when he lost the title. That was kind of filmed like handheld style, and it was shown to explain why Bret had this temperature and lost the title. If you remember that one in early 92.
So it was a definitely a deliberate tactic in these 92, 93 switches that were happening.
Yeah, I mean, it even occurred up to later 94. There was Money in Quebecers. I think they lost them, regained the titles, the Quebecers, in the UK tour. I think they lost them in London and regained them somewhere else, maybe in Germany. I can't remember offhand. But, you know, that was in 94 as well. So that was a reason to kind of push the European kind of dates as, you know, important and must see, with title changes potentially happening.
Yeah, the one that really interests me is the Morales Campatera one. Where did that happen? Because like 99% of all title switches would have happened in places like MSG or Philly, or sometimes the tag ones happen on TV. But I'm interested to know where that title switch actually took place. Did you have a hand there?
No, I don't have the way that one is actually. So we'll check that out as we go through the rest of the show, and we maybe just quickly just touch on that one again. So they're the ones I've kind of gone out about, the ones that haven't been filmed or made TV. So I hope that answers the question for you there, John, in Kansas City. So shall we move on to the second question, Parv?
Yeah, I can see it was does seem to be in a New York show. So maybe it was one of those weird MSG shows that wasn't filmed. Like there's a couple of, like a handful of MSG shows that, for whatever reason, didn't go out. So if anybody knows, let me know, because there's a big area of interest for me there. I'm sure Landy, if he listens, will know if that if that was an MSG show that just isn't on tape anywhere for whatever reason. So every once in a while they took a week off, you see, so it could be one of them.
Yeah, let's get to the second one before that. Landy 1987 is a great guy to follow on YouTube. He's got some fantastic footage, so check him out. So let's get to the second question then, Parv. So dear Alan and Parv, I was wondering who are some of the longest tenured Titan WWF WWE employees, and what are your thoughts about them? And that's from Paul Mann in Birmingham, England. So thanks for the question there, Paul. So it's quite a few guys that have had long tenures, long runs as employees or talent with Titan WWF WWF or WWE, isn't there, Parv?
Lots of them. Some of them dating back right back into the Vince Senior, and some of them even maybe going back into like the Toots Mont era. Alan, you want to go through some of these names?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that I've kind of dug up here is Gorilla Monsoon. He was onto a winner, really, though, Parv, because in 1982 he sold ownership in Capital to Vince K. McMahon. He was an employee for life. You know, that was from 63 to 99 till he passed away. So that was a fair few years he had working for the McMahons.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember one of the many disputes I got into with old John D. Williams on Pro Wrestling Only there was actually over exactly what Gorilla Monsoon's deal was. My understanding is that he got paid preliminary for every single live show that the WWF promoted. He would get the same pay as a prelim wrestler plus like 0.5 or something. So it was actually like a really good deal because...
Well, yeah, especially in the era when they were running four or five or even six shows, you know, a day, when they're running matinee shows as well. That money's coming in daily, you know, it soon adds up.
But I should mention that JDW disputes that for some reason, right? He just doesn't believe it for some reason, although Dave Meltzer does. So I just, for the, you know, historians disagree over whether that's true or not. But yeah, I mean, Gorilla, what can we say about him? I like him as a commentator. As I've said, I think he earned his money on the shows where not a lot is going on. Have you seen him much as a worker? I've seen him a little bit as a worker.
Bits and bobs, really. I mean, obviously, I've seen, you know, his angle with Muhammad Ali, and I've seen, you know, clips and footage of him, but I've never someone I've sought out as an in-ring guy.
I've seen him a little bit with the Titans of Wrestling in the late 70s there, when he was right at the tail end of his kind of working career. And he's actually a bit more mobile than you might imagine. Like, he was a big man, 400 pounds plus. But, you know, I watched him take a bump over the top to the outside, working a battle royal, which is a bump that you wouldn't expect a guy like him to take in 1980, you know?
Yeah.
And he was all right. And he had an amateur background, so he has pretty good fundamentals, you know?
An amateur background from where was he from? Manchuria?
Whatever. Well, I think he was actually like, there was talk like Gorilla was meant to be on like the Olympic team at one point. He just missed out. So he actually has like pretty good amateur credentials, which is why he knows like, quite a lot about like guys like Mr. Sato and Yatsu and stuff as well, because he remembers them from like back in the day, back in the 60s. So
Oh, that's interesting. So another guy that had a really long run was Steve Lombardi, the Brooklyn Brawler, from Jobber to the Brooklyn Brawler, and he kind of stuck with that gimmick from around 88, 89 time, and was around still making cups of coffee, cups of tea for people up as late as last year. So he was someone that was a trusted employee for Vince, I would imagine, would have a few skeletons in Vince's closet that he would know about.
Yeah, I've always wondered why he was employed for that long. Maybe he was just a nice guy, or maybe he was just loyal and hadn't, it's perfectly possible that the reason he was there for so long is that he was just a good employee and he could be trusted,
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. So there's not much really to talk about with Steve Lombardi. He was just a guy that worked, hundreds and thousands of matches. We may touch on him later in the show. So the next guy is Freddie Blassie, who was around from 73 all the way up till 2003 when he passed away. He was involved in, later on it would hardly have been anything. He would have got a Legends deal, would have been the first guys to get that. But, he was around for a long time, was a great servant, and someone that, a lot of memorable things happened with Blassie, and his charges that he was trying to manage to win the titles.
Yeah, well, obviously he was one of the three wise men there in the 70s. He actually comes a bit later than Grand Wizard and Albano, 73, that's quite late. And that's because, of course, he was a legendary wrestler in the 50s and the 60s. And I think he was even still working right at the beginning of the 70s there. I guess Blassie would have to be, if you want to say, most important wrestlers ever in the 20th century, he'd probably be in that bracket.
Oh, definitely. It was huge in Japan, huge all over the US, California, massive, and, a legend. It was, someone that was entertaining all the way up until, the mid-80s.
What's really interesting to me is I wonder what Blassie was doing there. After about 1987, where you didn't really see him much, they'd wheel him out once in a while, wouldn't they? I always remember that. What was that promo? Was it? When was it?
Was it the invasion angle when he came and rallied the troops?
No. There was that, but there was also the time a little bit beforehand when they were doing the New Generation deal, and he came out of the light and. I think Brett was the champ, and kind of Blassie was around for a little bit then, and then he was back later in the wheelchair later on. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I mean, he was around, but I don't know what he was doing in between that. Spokesperson, things of that nature, maybe, who knows? But yeah,
I reckon he was just doing what you always did, just playing cards in the back, I'd imagine.
The next one, who is someone who's been around for a hell of a long time, is the Fink, Howard Finkel. 77 up until present day, Parv. So that's for, in any job, never mind in pro wrestling, never mind in WWE, that's a hell of a long time for working for one employer.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because, Howard Finkel, as far as I can tell, is a true Vince Jr. guy. After Vince takes over, he kind of embeds him in the TV in a way that other guys, let me give you an other, say Gary Michael Capetta, right? My understanding is Capetta was basically just paid kind of cash in hand, and they got rid of him. They basically just said, well, there's not a job for you here anymore. Whereas Howard Finkel, if you watch the TV, he's doing the voiceovers. He's giving rundowns of cards on All Star and Championship Wrestling. He's really embedded in the product. Do you know what I mean? So he's not a contractor. He's always been an employee right from the very start, which is really interesting. And then when old Joe McHugh retires in 1984-85. Vince immediately brings Finkel in as the face of all ring announcers in the WWF, so that you look at Finkel and he's synonymous with ring announcing.
He's one of the best. He's the way that his credence is, the way that he pronounces things is just the voice of the WWF for me. In that role.
One of the things that's always interested me about Finkel. Because they phased him out, didn't they? It was Lillian Garcia was brought in, and God knows who does it now. Dave, what's his face? Is it P- Penza. What's his name?
Dave Penza. No, Dave Penza was WCW in the 90s.
Who's there now?
There's a rotating cast of characters. I mean, Lillian Garcia has gone home to look after her father who's ill. So you've got like JoJo. It's kind of small girl who does right. it. I can't even remember. You've got a UK guy that started on doing it now. I don't know what he's doing, but yeah, they're so interchangeable now for me. They don't stand out. That's why. I mean, I watched the product quite a lot. And I can't really remember who's doing it. I don't think Tony Chimmel's doing it anymore.
Chimmel. That's the guy I was trying to think of.
Oh yeah, he may be doing some stuff, but he's kind of head of the ring crew, I think.
Penta did work into like the later on though. Maybe he was with TNA for a while. I want to say. Something like that, maybe.
I don't know about him. There's like a few guys like that, but that's getting off topic. But getting back now, then a few guys
Hold on. What I wanted to know is that whenever Finkel would like appear on DVDs and things after, like Garcia mainly took over, he'd always be like brought up as like the head of statistics at the W. What do you think he does? What stats do you think he compiles?
He could be their version of Mookie Garner. You know, someone like that, Brandon Howard, someone who's into the WrestleNomics, so to speak, and just kind of records all the matches and all the times for everything and collates them. I don't know. It's not really a 40-hour job, is it?
Do you think if like John Cena goes ahead and like wins like the ties with Ric Flair's 16th title, like they have to bring in the Fink to make it like he's like the Guinness Book of Records, you know?
Yeah, he's like the guy used to do it on TV in the UK. That guy.
Anyway, let's carry on. Yeah.
All right. So yeah, there's a few other guys. Quickly, just to round up the question, there's Pat Patterson, 79 to 2016. Long time. Another Vince Jr. guy, Parv.
Yeah, and of course Pat Patterson, absolutely tremendous worker. In fact, for me, definitely the worker of the year in 1979, not just in the WF, probably like, you know, it'd be between him and like Tatsuji Fujinami for who was the best worker in the world that year. Really, really good worker, Pat Patterson. And then obviously his rep as one of the greatest minds in the business, the best Finnish guy in the business. And, by all accounts, all of those things are true. I've never heard anyone really say a bad word about him. Have you?
No, and he's the innovator of the Royal Rumble, or bringing it over from the Los Angeles kind of Battle Royals that they had, and San Francisco Battle Royals, and kind of bringing that more in and, you know, mixing, changing that to what it is now. And that's thanks to him on WWF. So next guy, Tony Garea, the man with the great hair, 72 till whenever. I haven't got a finish date with Tony Garea, but he may still be around in some way, shape or form, Paul.
Yeah, so I mean, Tony Garea was obviously like the staple of the tag division in the late 70s. And he's one of my friends, Johnny Sorrow's hero, Tony Garea, like really loves him. But then he really transitioned into being a jobber to the stars / like actual jobber by the mid-80s, Garea, and became a road agent, much like René Goulet, Alan, where
yes.
he'd crop up on TV to job once in a while, but really he was there as one of the original road agents, which is a structure that the WWE have kind of kept on ever since. They've always had those road agents, but basically like helping guys lay out matches, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, no, they've still got guys who do that up until now. And, you know, it's quite interesting that, you know, René Goulet and Tony Garea, they were the guys that came out in the like late 80s and 90s in the WWF suits, the nondescript guys that tried to split up, you know, things that happened in angles and brawls.
Yeah, they'd always be around. I mean, Chief J Strongbow was one as well. And I've listened to like old shoot interviews and things, and I always remember guys saying that they'd much prefer to have like Garea on their matches, or Goulet, or even Patterson, than someone like Chief J Strongbow, who was like a bit bitter and a bit kind of like, you know, didn't take retirement kindly type thing.
Yeah.
And, apparently, Blackjack Lanza, who was another guy who was always around in the background there somewhere, he was like a bit of a hard ass, so they'd rather have a Garea or a Goulet.
Right, so quickly now, just to end it, I'm just going to quickly go through these guys, and if you want to stop me at any point, Parv, please do. We've got Gerald Briscoe, been around since 84, still scouting up until today, doing the NCAA tournaments, things like that. Slowed down a bit. I think he had a minor heart attack a few years ago. But also we've got referee Mike Chioda. Been with the company since 89. He's the kind of head referee now. He refereed the Brock Lesnar Roman Reigns match, I believe, at WrestleMania 31, if memory serves me correctly. So he's a guy, as you know, come along. He was kind of a small little blonde guy at one point, referee. And, you know, he's still around now, so fair play to him. We've got Jim Johnson, who's been making music for the WWF, WWE, since 85. And he's still, you know, around doing things for them there. I mean, they've moved a lot of the kind of music style to... They've got like an in-house band now. I can't know how you pronounce the name, but it's got a dollar symbol in it. Right. The name of the band. They did kind of Rocky theme, Rocky kind of music. Also, we had Johnny Rods, who's been with WWE from the 60s up until about the mid-60s, till about 84, 85. And then went on to train a hell of a lot of guys as well.
And Johnny Rods was kind of like always talked about as being like the locker room leader, the kind of like the backstage enforcer. So even though he was a jobber of the stars on TV, a lot of the boys looked up to him. And if you can imagine being an outside worker going into that locker room, if you did anything to upset, like, he'd be one of the guys who, you know, would look at you the wrong way and you'd kind of, you'd fall into line type thing. So that was, I guess, he was one of Vince Sr.'s big guys, Johnny Rods, as far as I understand. And of course, they had a lot of Puerto Rican wrestlers moving through, and I think Johnny Rods would look after a lot of them as well on the heel side.
Yeah, so he was a loyal servant there. And last but no means least, Pedro Morales was there from around 64 time to the late 80s. He was announcing around, you know, when he finished up doing a Spanish broadcast, and he was a road agent, I think he did for some time as well. So he was someone that's a good 20-year run. But out of all those guys, the Fink still being there now from 77 is pretty damn impressive, wouldn't you say, Parv?
Absolutely incredible. He must really love it, the Fink. I mean, really, only Vince has been there longer at this point.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's a few wrestlers as well, just to quickly touch on them, that have been around as far as in-ring guys for, you know, quite a long time now. We've got The Undertaker, 1990. We've got Triple H, I think, Parv, 95.
Yeah, and we all know the story there.
Yeah, and who else have we got? There's a few other guys, isn't there?
Well, there was Arnold Scarland I wanted to mention quickly, because as I understand things, Arnold Scarland used to wrestle like back in like the 50s. And they even, like, on old TNT and things, show footage of Scarland from the 50s. And he was active at least until about 87. But he was one of those guys who had points in the promotion, just like Gorilla Monsoon. Mm-hmm. So he basically had a job for life, Scarland. So... like, I imagine that him and Blassie and Monsoon were back there playing cards, you know, all the time.
yeah.
Pretty much. Part of the furniture. And I say that because if you've ever seen Arlen Scarland, he does absolutely nothing as manager. Like, he doesn't give promos, he doesn't do anything.
I think the most famous thing he's ever did was throw the towel in for Backlund.
Yeah, that's literally it. Like what, 2 seconds of work to earn, like, 25 years worth of money type thing. I also heard somewhere that Arlen Scarland couldn't, like, was one of those guys who couldn't write, like, he signed his name with an X. Anyway, another guy, another, like, really old-time Capital Wrestling guy who worked for Vince Sr. in Chicago right up to the rock and wrestling era is Lou Albano. He had a full career as a tag wrestler with Tony Altimore, and then he, of course, became one of the Three Wise Men. And
yeah, from the Sicilians on, and then he was kept around for years. It was a promise made from Vince Sr. to Vince Jr. to keep Albano around.
And Albano even has, like, late runs, doesn't he? Like, even, like doesn't he, like, go off to become, like, Super Mario on TV and then, like, comes back even, like, he's even around in, like, 87 and stuff.
Oh, he's even around later than that. He's running around in 94 managing the Headshrinkers with Affa, if you remember.
That's right, yeah. So I want to say, though, because I saw him on that footage you put on working for Herb Abrams when, in, like, 1990. So he must have had, like, a few times away, because I think he famously had, like, quite a fiery relationship with Vince.
Oh, he was drunk. He was always drunk, wasn't he?
He was drunk, and he'd call him Junior and Vinny.
He was quite belligerent, yeah. So
even though Vince hated him, but like I think continuous employment was at least something like 61 to 85, I'd say.
Yeah, so there's the guys really that we kind of looked at and we could find who'd been there for a long time. So I hope that answers Paul's question. So should we move on to the next one, Parv?
Absolutely.
Okay, so question number three this week is, what wrestler retirements were acknowledged on TV? And that's from Jason Powers in Troy, New York. So thank you for the question there, Jason. So the ones that we could kind of dig up, the most famous one was the Roddy Piper WrestleMania 3 one, Parv. That was kind of built up for a number of months leading up to the match against Adrian Adonis.
Yeah, and what happened? He beat Adonis, and... what happens then? He basically comes back for a bit as a babyface. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he retired in 87, so he kind of had the deal, with Adonis. So he ended up with Beefcake at the end and shaving his head. And congratulations from.
He basically goes off to make the film. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's making They Live. Film. And I know he did Hell Comes to Frogtown, which was another one he starred in, which is fairly popular-ish as a B movie goes, I think. He was doing other things, but yeah, it was one that was kind of pushed on TV. I put a video up on the playlist where they did a My Way, I think, Frank Sinatra backing video montage of his kind of career. He introduced it with Gene Okerlund, so that's quite interesting if people want to check that out.
Wow, and the thing that was really amazing to think about, like that video. Really, they've only got footage of like a couple of years, but they're making out like it'd be like, big long career or whatever. But
yeah, you've been there for about 3 years, haven't
you? On screen, it's basically like 3 years, which doesn't seem that much in light of what we've just been talking about.
No, exactly. Another guy was Pete Doherty, a guy that, I only uncovered Pete Doherty in the last, I would say, for me, 5 years or so, Paul, because he was never, ever featured in anything, that I saw. And what a wacky character he was.
The Duke of Dorchester, yeah. Well, maybe we'll have cause to come back to him in our long topic.
Yeah, he was announced to have retired in 1987 on TV. But he turned up when I was doing the research. That was all announced, and it was acknowledged on TV that he was retiring. But that, lo and behold, he was back in 1988 doing jobs. So I thought, oh, nice one, Doherty, ruining my research by doing that. But yeah, he was a guy that was at least acknowledged as retiring on TV.
And that's because he was like a really bad colour announcer, basically, like a colour. He's part of some truly woeful colour announcing teams. I can see, here in the Boston, he's with Gorilla and Lord Al. That's fine, but wait until he's on there with, Mike McGurk and bloody Bruce Pritchard. Oh, it's just... Some of those shows are really brutal with the commentary. Or, there's some really bad teams in and around 87.
There's all sorts of random people turn up. You got Bruno Sammartino still knocking around. You have Nick Bockwinkle turns up. You got superstar Billy Graham. Yeah. You've got all sorts of people coming and going.
None worse than Pete Doherty with Mike McGurk. Oh, my God. Mike McGurk's the one with the female ring announcer?
Oh, yeah. One of the big ones. Leroy McGurk's daughter called her Mike. I think that was quite interesting she got that name.
She is immortalised on the WrestleFest arcade game. She's like the
best one there. Yeah, she was a good announcer, to be fair to her.
She was good. She was good as a ring announcer, but just not to be in the booth.
No. Another one was famously was Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7. He lost the retirement match, or he lost the match where he said he'd retire, and that was the Ultimate Warrior. And he was planning, I believe, at that time to try and start a family with Elizabeth. That didn't kind of pan out, and he was back. Trying to petition, as we've touched on before, later on in 91.
Petitioned Tunney, of course.
Smashed up Tunney's office as well, if you remember.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had Savage there. Another one, which I love the footage of this, and I'll put it on the playlist, and hopefully you can check that out, guys. It was Lou Albano when he retires in 86, and he shows him backstage with wrestlers and champagne kind of flowing celebration, and Johnny V, who we spoke about last week, smashes a cake in Albano's face. It's a great little bit of footage there.
What, he retires from the ring in 1986?
No, he retires as a manager.
Oh, does he really? Oh, I didn't know that. I'm going to have to check that out. So what does he do afterwards? He just like appears as a personality type thing.
Well, I don't know what he's up to after that, but it was like as an acknowledged retirement, as hence the question goes. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, the back, as we've touched on with all of them, really. Randy Savage there, Lou Albano, Pete there, Doc T, and Roddy Piper. But they're the ones that were acknowledged on TV around this era as kind of retiring. Obviously, there's other guys as well later on, like Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels.
Of course, I mean, Ric Flair's a big one, of course. Michaels, Austin basically just retired and stayed retired, didn't he?
Yeah, but it was never really acknowledged on TV, was it? As it was a retirement as such.
Not really. I'm just trying to think now. Gorilla Monsoon was retired in an angle against Ken Patero in 1980, which I watched. Surprisingly good match. And I was watching a show with the Place to Be guys a couple of weeks ago. And Monsoon just like brings it up. He just kind of, Patera's on the card and he says, well, you know, don't underestimate Ken Patera. He retired me and I am retired. And every once in a while, they'll bring up the fact that Monsoon was a wrestler. And like Lord R will press him, you know, are you going to come back to the ring then, Gorilla? And he's like, no, I am retired. I'm staying retired.
All right.
So that's one of the ones that is talked about on air fairly frequently, actually. Ventura once in a while will mention that he's retired, although how that comes about I'm not sure exactly, because he was injured and then kind of transitions to be an announcer. Can you think of any more like retirements on
not really off the top of my head that were pushed as retiring, you know, in the era that we cover.
There's Bruno, of course, who retires famously. And then he comes out of retirement in our era to tag with his son, to tag with David Sammartino.
Yeah, and he's feuding with Savage as well in tags, isn't he, in 86?
So he comes out of retirement, basically, in order to do that. So I guess that's an acknowledgement of a retirement. But they tended not to acknowledge stuff like that on air very often, which is why it's actually quite rare. Did anyone else? Did Hogan retire? He didn't really, did he?
No, he just kind of went away.
That's what happened. Like, guys basically went away, brackets, went to WCW. That's basically what happened most of the time.
Yeah, they went somewhere else. Yeah, they went to Turner. But yeah, if there's any other guys that we've kind of missed that were kind of acknowledged on TV, let us know, guys. So they're the three kind of short questions. Do we still have time for the long question?
Yeah, well, let's quickly go to JT Rosero. And when we come back, we'll hit that long topic, Alan.
Thank you, Parv. Thank you, Alan. JT Rosero here inside the Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. And this week, I want to take you back to January 19th, 1992 in Albany, New York, for that year's Royal Rumble, of course, considered by many fans to be one of the greatest matches of all time. The Masked Star Ric Flair enter at number 3 and lasts over an hour to take home the World Wrestling Federation heavyweight title. Of course, featured iconic commentary from Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan, with the Brain freaking out the entire time that Flair was in the ring, going apeshit over every near elimination, every close call. And in the end, Flair outlasted a star-studded field to take home the gold. Roddy Piper, IRS, the British Bulldog, Randy Savage, Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, Tito Santana, Kerry Von Erich, Hulk Hogan, Jake Roberts, Big Boss Man, Randy Savage, Ted DiBiase, so many big, massive names in that match in that year. Many would go on to become Hall of Famers, or they already were at that time. Even guys like the Iron Sheik trolling around in that match as well. Undercard, not as exciting, But there was a big moment when Roddy Piper defeated the Mountie to win his first singles title in the World Wrestling Federation, winning the IC belt via sleeper. Of course, also on that card, Owen Hart and Jim Neidhart defeated the Orient Express. The Natural Disasters defeated Legion of Doom by countout to retain the tag titles. And the Beverly Brothers defeated the Bushwhackers in 15 minutes of boredom. I'm sure you've all seen this card, but if you haven't, it's on the WWE Network, and it's a must-watch, especially the Royal Rumble match itself, because we've had some close calls, but it's hard to argue that many have surpassed the greatness put on that night in Albany. I'm sure we'll talk about this year's Royal Rumble on other podcasts here at PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Be sure to subscribe to all of our podcast feeds on iTunes, the PlaceToBeNation Wrestling, PlaceToBeNation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only feeds. Follow us on social media for updates as well. So, back to the lads across the pond. I'm JT. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thank you very much. Fascinating as ever, JT. And nice to note that you're actually in the correct week this week, Justin.
Yeah.
let's see what our long question is then.
Okay, so the long question to wrap up the show this week is, dear Alan and Parv, who were some of your favourite WWF jobbers? Keep up the great work. And that's from Graham Steverly in Glasgow, Scotland. So, Parv, WWF jobbers, we've seen hundreds of them throughout the years. You may have different criteria than me why you like certain people, why they're memorable to you, why they're your favorite. So let's start with some of yours. Who are guys that you enjoyed seeing get beaten?
I like to see jobbers as being guys who are kind of a bit out of shape, pudgy looking, wimpy, have like no chance in hell of being of like winning at all. And they've got like really basic names, like, you know, whatever it is, you know, like this one here, Joe Myrto, for example, that you've put, like, they clearly just don't have much of a name, all the rest of it. So let me think. We mentioned one very notable jobber, which is the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty. I have described him as being like almost like the Terry Funk of jobbers, Alan. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, he's got a very distinctive style, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's got a definite distinct style, and I love when he comes into battle royals with his armor. I don't know if you've ever seen him do that, Parv.
what do you mean battle royals in his armor?
Well, he's the Duke of Dorchester, isn't he? So he wore this kind of armor like he was something from the, you know, 10th century or something, battling you know, one of those coat of arms.
I see. Okay,
you have to check that one out then.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, but just talking about him though, as far as Pete Doherty goes, he actually won 20% of his matches.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Who was he beating?
I don't know who he was beating. I've got these stats in front of me, thanks to Chris Harrington, Mookie Garner, who's put them up on his site. Here you can check that out if you just Google Mookie Garner WWF jobbers. He's got 20% win.
I seem to remember, because on another show I do here, Titans of Wrestling, which I've mentioned a few times today, Kelly is like, he loves jobbers. That's his thing. He's like a jobber lover. And he takes delight in giving bios of really like obscure jobbers, you know, like guys who only turned up for like a month and stuff like that. And a lot of Pete Doherty's wins come at the Zembo Mosque. That is like the house of Doherty there. Like he tends to win at the Zembo Mosque. So yeah, that's just one of those little quirks.
So yeah, he's a jobber that had some of the, you know, the biggest success, but I mean, for me, the best jobbers should be the ones that never win and do their job. I mean, you know, looking at the most famous ones that people remember, you've got your Brooklyn Brawler, Steve Lombardi's, Jose Estrada, Barry Horowitz, Frank Williams, Steve King, Danny Davis. You know, those guys, they all won, you know, over 10% of their matches.
Well, okay, so who are the true jobbers then?
Well, the true jobbers, the ones that, you know, got 0% wins or 1% wins, these are the guys that I want to talk about. The first one, Dale Wolf. You must have seen some Dale Wolf stuff.
Yeah, doesn't he also go by, like, Dusty Wolf at some
time? Yeah, I mean, I'll read this little bio about him. Wolf is best known for his long tenure as a jobber in what then was known as WWF, making his debut there as Dusty Wolf in March 87. In June 89, WWF began billing him as Dale Wolf, as just as to not distinguish him, you know, away from Dusty Rhodes, who had just left WCW for WWF. The two wrestled each other on television later that year. During his time in the WWF, Wolf wrestled as both a babyface and a heel. Famed for his permanent look of confusion and his poorly cut mullet, Dale Wolf was one of the most prolific wrestlers of the WWF in the Hulk Hogan era. Too bad he never won. A respectful but feisty competitor, Wolf would often lose his cool after being slapped by the likes of Mr. Perfect or Ravishing Rick Rude. Wolf's defining moment came when he attempted to one-up the Hulkster by taking down the hated Sid Justice just prior to the highly anticipated WrestleMania showdown between Hogan and Justice. Assumably, there was no on-screen reason given for the match between Sid and Dale. Wolf didn't get a single move or punch in before being decimated by Sid. After the match, while he was being stretched out, Sid clotheslined him back to the floor. So he had 104 matches and lost 104 matches in his WWF run. So take a bow, Dale Wolf.
That reminds me of, like, do you ever play the old game, like, Punch-Out or Super Punch-Out?
Yeah.
Do you remember that, like, old guy, Gabby J, like, yay! He had, like 99 losses, 99 matches, 99 losses. Okay, brilliant.
So,
like,
he's one of them. So another one who had 0% win is Rick Hunter.
My
I don't know if you... Do you remember him ever in any squashes, Parv?
Oh, yeah. I've definitely seen Rick Hunter in my time. Definitely. Well,
yeah, so here's my little bio on him. Approaching 50 years of age and beyond his prime, Charles B. Sprott joined the WWF in mid-1985, shortly after the first WrestleMania. In the WWF, he performed as both Rick Hunter and the Gladiator, with both characters taking on the role of Jobber, cleanly losing to the stars of the day. Both Rick Hunter and the Gladiator made regular appearances on WWF Championship Wrestling and later WWF Superstars of Wrestling, the WWF's nationally and internationally broadcast weekly television shows. Despite the sustained record of losses at the time, Sprott's personas, particularly Rick Hunter, put up credible performances, and he was sometimes teamed with bigger names to take the pinfall in tag matches. Ironically, by performing as both a masked and unmasked wrestler, one of Sprott's characters was often used as a heel or bad guy, losing to the big name face or good guy characters, while his other persona could be a face losing to the big name heels. This, along with the ability to put on credible matches, made Sprott a very useful jobber for the bookers, as he was able to take on a multitude of roles. Sprott stated that at the time he would wrestle two matches in a night, one in each character. Sprott's last recorded match with the WWF was on 9th of March 88 in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where he defeated the One Man Gang. So he had 81 matches that he lost, Parv, and won no contest. So he didn't win any of them.
And I seem to remember that Rick Hunter was like a fairly like well-traveled worker. Like, he was a journeyman, obviously, and a job. Like, he was basically like... someone like he had a career a bit like a Doug Summers, someone like that. But he like worked all over the place in all the different territories. Like, he was a, do you know what I mean? Like, he wasn't like a career job guy. He was basically like a worker right at the end of his career type thing. So he could actually go a bit, you know, I guess, for a job.
Well, yeah, well, the Gladiator character on TV was one of the worst kept secrets, because Bruno Sammartino called the guy when he was working against King Tonga. He said basically there's no way Hunter could get out of that one. So he acknowledged him as Rick Hunter. So he slipped up there. So people knew the Gladiator was actually Rick Hunter. But another guy was Brian Costello, who actually had 100 matches and he won one of those matches, Parv. And that match was against, was it Jose, how do you pronounce the name? Is it Jose Deluc? You know, the French Canadian guy, the lumberjack.
Oh, I just say Jos Deluc. That's what I say.
Yeah. He defeated him by DQ at 159 in 1988 as Leduc refused to stop headbutting him. And then Leduc was billed as the headbanger from that point, if you remember, Parv.
Yeah. So what's the deal with that win? Do you know this, like, why did he win that one match?
I don't know, just to fit the angle that, you know, Leduc was going to be the headbanger. So to get that, you know, moniker over, he started headbutting his guy till he got DQ'd. So that was the one win there for Brian Costello. And Joe Murto, here's another guy who had only 1% wins, who had 95 matches. He played for the Miami Dolphins, the Joe Murto, and he was kind of built in a way like Sweet Hansen, kind of a big guy. They used him in kind of quite a few of the matches in, you know, the 80s, and he actually beat Steve Lombardi. He gave him this one win in 1987, so I don't know if it was his birthday Or was a rib on Lombardi at the time. But yeah, that was his win. So those guys are the guys that have really got a real bad win-loss record, who were the ultimate jobbers. But like I said before, Parv, there's lots of guys as well. There's like Louis Spicoli was like a really good jobber, if you remember him in the 80s, before he went on and, you know, worked as Madonna's boyfriend in AAA, and Louis Spicoli in ECW and WCW as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of like the ones who really stand out to me. You see, sometimes there are wrestlers who are either like at the tail end of their career, a bit like Rick Hunter, who stand out. That one of them is called Paul Christie. Have you ever come across him? He's got like a really cool like Elvis haircut. Like he kind of looks a bit cooler than your average jobber.
Is his dad Tony Christie, the UK singer, Parv, if you know.
No. I think he's like an old like WWE guy, like a kind of Dick the Bruiser guy.
Yeah.
But like he crops up at some point. I think like 86 sort of time he's around. I always like to see him just because he's got cool hair. And he may get in a little bit of offense once in a while. There's also Billy Joe Travis, or Billy Travis. Do you remember him?
Yeah. I mean, Billy Travis, he was great in Memphis.
So really good in Memphis. But in 84, he's basically a jobber in WWF. But, like, he's got all the tools that you'd want from it. Like, he's really good at taking offense and, you know, bumping off the ropes and things like that. I like a jobber to kind of bounce around, make guys look really good. Billy Travis is actually one of the better jobbers.
Well, talking about kind of guys that did a lot of jobs that weren't jobbers, here's some interesting stats. And these, again, are thanks to Mookie Garner, Chris Harrington on his page. So SD Jones, you know, he's a famous jobber. He had the most losses in a single year, and he lost 141 times in 84 and 142 times in 1985.
Wow.
So that's a lot of time staring up at the lights.
Yeah, but he was still kind of like billed as, you know, he was still bigger star than any other, like still basically a JTTS, even though he's technically jobbing more than anyone on the roster.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some other kind of names like that as well. Yeah, Johnny Rods, 122 losses in 82, 131 in 83, and 136 in 84. And he was another guy that was at that level, wasn't he, as an SD Jones?
That's right.
As well, then we had Owen Hart, 140 losses in 1994, Parv. Obviously, all against Brett on the road.
Yeah.
But that's quite interesting.
And that's basically like during a push. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and another one during a push as well. Mr. Fuji, tag team champion, he lost 157 times in 1982.
Holy shit. Like, that was probably like a ton of like count out losses against the Strongbows or something. Bollocks, you know.
Yeah, and then someone else as well we had was interesting, was the Iron Sheik. So he lost the title in 84, early 84. Then he lost 121 times in 84, and 143 times in 85, and 103 times in 86. So wow. That's a fall from grace in a way, isn't it, Bob? I mean, even though he was still higher up on the card, so his paydays were, you know, still all right. But, you know, he wasn't winning a lot of these matches.
I wonder what his win-loss record was like as Colonel Mustafa. That'd be interesting to know.
Yeah.
Because he's basically a jobber to the stars at that point. But during this run, he's the tag team champion and stuff, isn't he?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And, like, you know,
that's like doing like the whole Sergeant Slaughter feud and everything. He's like one of the top heels in the company at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this is what people don't realise. We've got, as well, more modern-day guys. We've got The Miz. You know, Mike Mazzeian, 134 times he lost in 2011. And he was, around this time, was kind of headlining WrestleMania, or, you know, a couple of years just removed to that.
One of the things people forget, though, is that if you're a heel and you work a lot, you're going to lose, heels lose a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's their shtick, that's what they have to do. I mean, the best example of that is Ric Flair, 1992, 149 losses, Parv.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I wouldn't be surprised if you got, like, peak Horseman, like 86, 87, 88. And looked at like Arn and Tully and Ric Flair's win-loss records, and I bet you that they're in triple figures. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, there's loads of guys here in this time frame as well. We've got Triple H, 129 losses in 96. Goldust, 123 losses in 96. Randy Savage, 121 losses in 1990. Bossman, 123 losses in 89. Papa Shango, 125 losses in 92. And Repo Man, 121 losses in 92 as well.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I'd be interested to know some of Ted. Is Ted DiBiase on any of those lists?
No, he's not coming up as a guy that was making triple figures.
Interesting. I'm just like, because as far as I can, because you know what it's like, Alan, over the years, you look at many, many results. Like, especially us, like, proper, like, hardcore fans, we're always looking through lists of results. And you notice, like, I always notice patterns that what they do is they lock guys in, like, a house show feud, okay? Let's just say, for example, two guys who are married together for, like, 4 or 5 months. I don't know. Let's say it was DiBiase and Tito Santana for a period, like, for example. And then you have a look, like, down, like, the house shows, and they'll just have, like, the same result night after night after night. You know, count out loss, count out loss, count out loss. Then they'll have, like, the one TV match will be, like, a double count out, or they'll change up the finish for that one TV match. And then for the rest of the house show matches, it will just be, like, the same finish. And that's how a lot of these guys are racking up these huge amounts of losses. It'll just be, like, the same result night after night. I'd imagine, like, Savage job to Dusty Rhodes, like...
Yeah, in 1990, a hell of a lot.
Like, a huge amount. But a load of them would be, like, countouts, or even, like, he'd just put him over on, you know, in front of 3,000 people in Milwaukee, or whatever it was, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, another example, the last one I want to make is Greg Valentine, 85, lost 126 times.
Wow, and he'd just been the tag champ, hadn't he?
Mm-hmm. Well, he was. The Dream Team won the titles. No, they won them in 86. But he'd just been the IC champ.
He'd just been the IC champ. And he was basically one of the biggest heels on the roster in 85. I bet you, like, a ton of them were against Tito. Those losses.
I bet they were as well. So, yeah, we kind of parlayed the question then from jobbers to guys that did a lot of jobs. But I hope we covered a big, large kind of gamut of information there for you guys.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to think of any other, like, notable jobbers.
Well, you got a notable kind of jobbers, Iron Mike Sharp.
Yeah, he was very, like, loud always, but, like, even Iron Mike Sharp... Iron Mike Sharp would often get, like, the 10-minute house show match. So he'd actually be in, like, longer matches, and he'd even win once in a while. So, and even SD Jones would win once in a while, which is why they're not, like, the true jobbers, Alan.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Well,
like,
who is your true jobber, then? Who is your number one?
Just trying to think now, who would be in that category. It's basically like the sort of guy who'd be losing to, like, Lanny Poffo in 1988, for example.
Well, I'll play a guessing game. How many matches do you think Steve Lombardi actually had in the WWF?
Period.
Completely, yeah, from his 83 to whatever run, 90s.
Well, I reckon there would be loads of time where he wouldn't be working every night. So I'm going to say 600 matches.
No, he had 1,503 matches.
Holy shit.
Okay. So he had more matches than anyone, you know, in this kind of undercard talent list.
Holy shit.
I mean, I'd have to look at, you know, there's guys have had more matches than him now overall, but that is a hell of a lot of matches. You know, for someone that was never pushed particularly hard, only won 11% of his matches.
My God. Okay. And did he get... how many wins did he get out of that?
Like I touched on before, 11% of wins. But I think what I'll do is I'll send this over to you, Parvin. If you put it in the show description, then people can check this out, because it's a lot of good work that Chris Harrington does, and there's a lot of more interesting stats on his website that people may, you know, get a kick out of.
Yeah, really interesting. I'm just trying to find out who Lanny Poffo was beating. And now that I'm looking at it, he actually went over quite a lot of big names, like Jim Powers and...
Big names, yeah. Virgil, did he go over Virgil?
Paul Roma and Coco Ware, I mean...
Talking of Paul Roma, today I saw this awesome top row elbow drop that he does. I mean, it's not in WWF, it's in WCW in 94, when it's him and Paul Orndorff versus the Fantastics, Parv, on a random syndicated show in 94.
Okay,
and he does this awesome top row elbow drop to win the match.
Wow. Okay, I actually think Paul Roma is a little like a weensy bit underrated, just because like he'll always be known for being like the horseman who never should have been, but he wasn't like awful. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think he was just such a letdown in that role.
Would you take him over Tom Zenk?
As a horseman general?
No, just in general.
They're just kind of both guys with springs in the legs, you know, a lot of times in the 80s, bouncing up and down. So I can take or leave either of them.
okay. Yeah, well, I guess the best jobber is the jobber that you don't remember. We should probably mention Frank Williams as like the quintessential jobber of all jobbers, but he only sneaks into our era as the guy who's bullied by Roddy Piper, as we've talked about before.
Well, Frank Williams, 10% win rate he had.
Oh God. One of the, just while we're on the subject of jobbers, before we sign off, Alan. One of the things that I've always been fascinated by, especially by like a Frank Williams or one of these guys who read like the Dusty Wolfer you mentioned, like if left to their own devices, like let's say they're against a guy who just won't punch back, won't fight back. What do they do like when they're on top? What's their like finisher? Do they have like what's the sequence? What's like an offensive sequence for the Dale Wolf or? Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, the only kind of the moves that they would do would, you'll get Irish whips, clotheslines, punches in the corner, kicks. You're not going to get maybe an elbow drop. You're not going to get a great deal more than that. I don't think you're going to get many slams either because a lot of these guys were a little bit smaller than the guys they were working against.
I would love to see that play out once. And like, what would you do against someone who's just let you like? That's it.
Well, there should have been a rib, shouldn't there? There should have been. I wish there was a. You know, there may have been ribs, and then we're never going to see them, obviously. But I bet there may have been one or two over the years where guys did that.
Frank Williams versus Dale Wolf, like time limit draw because neither guy knew how to finish the match.
You and the other guy, knew how to pin. Yeah, they didn't know.
Like, I wonder if he ever had a near fall in that 104 matches. All right. Well, I think that'll do for this week. So. Let's just remind listeners, because we want your letters, we want to keep on seeing them, how can you get in touch?
Okay, best ways, again, like I said earlier, was lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com or hashtag lettersfromkayfabe on Twitter. Send your questions in either way and we'll get to them and we'll answer them in shows in the future. So, we'd love that. More questions, the merrier.
Great. Well, join us next week for Letters from Kayfabe.
Adios.
We've had a number of unsung heroes thus far on TNT, most of whom, with the exception of maybe Rusty Brooks and to a certain extent Jose Luis Rivera, have not had a great deal of experience. Separating them from the next series of guests in terms of unsung heroes who have had a great deal of experience, all three of them, would you please welcome Charlie Fulton, Pete Daugherty, and the unpredictable Johnny Rods. Gentlemen, if you would, please. The unpredictable Johnny Rods. That perhaps more aptly describes anyone. I think maybe you more than anyone else, Johnny. I mean, your unpredictable nature, both inside as well as outside of the ring. In terms of what you do in the ring, it appears from time to time that even you don't have a well-thought-out plan.
Do you know who gave me the name Unpredictable?
No, I haven't a clue. Who gave you the name?
You don't know. You did.
Really?
You didn't even know that.
But that is you, Mr. Rods, is it not?
The one and only.
Well, I mean, do you calculate maneuvers ahead of time or
No, I just play by it. Whatever comes in that ring, that's what I'm going to do. And that goes with the opponent they give me. If he's rough, I'm rough. Whatever he's got, I have. Whatever happens, that's it.
Well, now, on the other hand, Pete Daugherty, generally speaking, you're much more predictable. I mean, we can... Look at that kid.
I am not homicidal, suicidal, or psychotic, McMahon.
I don't recall anyone stating that you were, Mr. Daugherty. I just meant you are more predictable in terms of...
I am unpredictable. I'm just as unpredictable as Johnny Rotz and Charlie Fulton right here. I'm the Duke of Dorchester, by the way, too. Whenever you introduce me as the Duke of Dorchester. I work hard for that title, and I want it.
The Duke?
Duke of Dorchester, baby!
You earned it already.
I came all the way from the dukedom to get to here!
Mr. Daugherty, get a hold of yourself.
And you call me.
I got a hold of myself! I am not suicidal, homicidal, or schizophrenic! I'm just as sane as he is, and a guy on the end.
Thank you.
All right, what we would like to do is, and we'll come back and have a little chit-chat with Charlie Fulton as well, all three of you gentlemen in individual competition, Pete Doherty, Charlie Fulton, and Johnny Rods, let's take you now to the videotape footage. Johnny Rods against Hulk Hogan, you certainly had your moments in that matchup.
Yes, very close encounter. Yes, I did. And I tell you, I was this close from being a champ. They wasn't calling the title match, but you see how slow that referee was there?
Good point. The referee cannot always be in the proper position. Charlie, we saw you in your matchup with Barry Windham, a seesaw matchup back and forth. We've seen you in individual competition as well as tag team competition. Which do you prefer, tag team or individual?
I prefer individual competition myself. Just as you seen that match with Barry Windham, it was a give-and-take match back and forth. But you saw as the camera came on, he had me in a front face lock and... what was supposedly a front face lock, but was, more like a chokehold.
It was like a chokehold.
Exactly like one.
Well, I've been on that, and it's I think it's a chokehold. Yeah. He uses it, he gets the hole out of you, and you don't let go, it comes in, and by the time you get down there, you're choked up, but that's, I don't call it anything else but a chokehold.
Well, then again, though, all three of you have resorted
There's no way you get that kind of hole on, and he's running with you. And but there's no way the referee could check it, and he could do anything he wants with that. That's a good one for me.
Very valid point.
If you were really going to show tribute to the unsung heroes of this business, why did you show that piece of junk there where the man obviously cheated?
In terms of your match with the Superfly?
With Superfly Snooker.
He cheated?
And what you've seen it with your own eyes. What are you, blind McMahon? I'm going back to the Middle East where people speak to me with respect and address me by their proper title.
Which is?
The Duke of Dorchester.
The Duke of Dorchester.
Yes.
And you're recognized as among the royal families in the Middle East?
I am. I was out on a cruise. I went to the island of Falaka.
The island of what?
Falaka.
What country is that in?
In Kuwait.
The island of Fulaka.
That's correct.
What is the island of Fulaka known for?
It is one of the greatest islands in the world. It has on it the last remains of the Gunga Ding or whatever. What's the thing?
The Gunga Ding.
The Gunga Ding. It has on it digs that are 5,000 years old. What are you laughing at, Chuck?
Only the accent.
I'm putting out some real good history here for you, baby, and you gotta learn it.
Gunga Ding.
Gunga Ding, the last outpost of Gunga Ding. On the island of La Falaka.
Island of La Falaka.
You got it, Jack.
Well, I've never been there.
Well, a man of your caliber would never ever make it there.
Well, perhaps.
You have to have a little class, address people by the proper.
Perhaps everyone should tour the remains of Gunga Ding.
That's correct.